Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. A guest has been hunting these Nephilim, or the traces of them, for quite some time now. He makes frequent appearances on Coast to Coast AM. You'll see him in coming days on the History Channel, a new series focusing on the search for the giants. He's the co-creator of the Watchers series of DVDs and the host of Watchers TV, the author of 9 books, including the latest, On the Trail of the Nephilim 2, New Archaeological Research. It's our honor to welcome L.A. Marzulli back to the program. L.A., it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, good to be here, Derek. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
And I will say again that you are, along with Chuck Missler, responsible for getting me into this for over the last 10 years. It was there was an evangelist at a small independent Baptist church in St. Louis that was preaching on Genesis 6 one night and at a revival on prophecy. And I turned to Sharon afterwards. I said, "Have you ever heard about that stuff?" She said, "Oh, yeah." So I immediately went to the local St. Louis County Library branch, found your novel.
Wow.
The first one from the Nephilim series, and then shortly thereafter found Chuck Missler's book on
Alien Encounters.
Encounters. I keep forgetting the name of the book. But anyway, those two really led me into, you know, it's like, wow, so maybe there is, because I've been a sci-fi fan my entire life. And when I began to realize that there's no contradiction between a Christian worldview and science fiction, because the palette is right there in the Bible. You know, you got the characters and the conflict to draw on to write some incredible fiction, as our friend Brian Godawa is showing, and Mike Heiser. You don't have to be ashamed or afraid to say you're a Christian and still have an interest in things that are supposedly too weird to talk about on Sunday mornings.
Absolutely. I certainly concur with that.
So, we've talked in other interviews, and I'll point people to links in the show notes to go back and get some background on your story and what led you into all of this, because really I think we can easily fill the next hour just talking about what you've discovered and what you've included in the new book, On the Trail of the Nephilim 2. After the first book, which included a lot of documentation from old newspaper accounts of giant skeletons found here in the United States, what more out there was there that led you to write a follow-up volume?
Well, I mean, if you actually look at the table of contents, there's so much material. I actually have about 5 or 6 chapters for book volume 3 that we're working on. Volume 3 probably has another, 15,000-20,000 words already written of different chapters, lots of different research, places that we've been that we just did not put it in. To volume 2, 266 pages, lots and lots of photographs. One of the more poignant moments for me was the Catalina research that we had done. And this sort of, I've been following the whole, all the paper articles, newspaper articles from the turn of the last century about allegedly 9-footers being found in Catalina. And that's all very colorful and it's great. And meeting with archaeologists here, and of course, they just poo-poo all that, and they say it's guys are trying to sell papers, and it didn't happen, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, we have the Native American oral tradition, which tells us, yeah, they were 9-footers with red hair, and they were cannibals with 6 fingers, some of them. So, you know, who are we to believe? The Native Americans who were here before any of this started, or, you know, a couple of archaeologists that have perhaps a paradigm axe to grind, if that's correct English, I'm not sure it is or not. But the Catalina, what we discovered in Peru, unwrapping the baby's head, and how that ties into 1842 and discoveries that were done there. The Nephilim lands, my time with Chief Joseph, Bob Shelley, and what we now have come to call the Nephilim lands, which was this very large bronze object found up in Michigan in a remote campsite, just abandoned there. And we've had it tested and we're still not sure exactly what we're looking at, but it's nothing like we've ever seen. And it actually ties back into the biblical narrative when it says Ishbi Benob's spearhead weighs 300 shekels. Mm-hmm. You convert the shekels to pounds, you get 7.5 pounds. That's exactly the weight of the lance head. Chief Joseph maintains that it's definitely not Native American at all. And it's very primitive. The copper is, we had the copper tested. It's very extremely pure copper. And of course, this jibes right into the idea that lots and lots, tons of copper were mined out in Michigan. It's gone missing. No one knows where it went. And this, you know, in our opinion, this sort of maybe links into that. It also ties into the Native American tradition where these red-haired giants would come in with these long lances and they would skewer three Native Americans with the lance. Now, that's what Chief Joseph told me. That's all in the new book. So, I mean, that just mm-hmm. sort of whets your appetite of just some of the what we discovered in Volume 3. But the pictures from Catalina, that's why I'm on the History Channel this coming Tuesday. Because
let's go ahead and talk about that. We'll start there. I want to get more into the lance because that's fascinating. And the pictures of that are fascinating as well. But Ralph Glidden and the discoveries that he made, 19th century on Catalina Island, or was it early 20th?
It was early 20th from about 1919 up. In the early days, Glidden was employed by the High Museum. The High Museum later got gobbled up by the Smithsonian. He did things, and in some ways, he's a little more than a grave robber. Okay, I get it. And I concur with that assessment. And his museum was incredibly macabre and had nothing to do with it was more like a Barnum and Bailey sideshow, something that, you know, somebody's uncle, you're tacking his pelvis on the wall. I mean, you know, his thigh bones decorating this macabre, quote unquote, museum.
Yeah, and those strings of in the photo, it almost looks like strings of popcorn that you hang at Christmas time. What are those, teeth?
Yeah, it's very macabre and shows very little respect to the human remains.
Yeah.
And I get that, and I'm on board with that. Just as a sidebar, real quickly, I went to an undisclosed location on the trail, and it was like a scene out of Goonies. We walked down the building was about 150 years old. We walked down in this cellar, down these rickety steps, and got to the bottom after about 20 steps, and there was a plank walkway with lights that were strung up on the wall with an extension cord, like 20 feet. Every 20 feet, there was another light bulb. And we walked down this planking, like a boardwalk, and got to the end and descended another 20 steps. And I'm saying to myself, oh, you've got to be kidding me. And when I got down to the lower level, we walked to the very end, and I said, well, where is it? And the man pointed up there. There was a skeleton. And I got on a ladder and slid back the panel and held my breath, and in front of me is a 5'7" Native American skeleton. And I just told him, I said, look, this thing needs to be repatriated. It's somebody's uncle. It's somebody's relative. But that's not what we're looking for. That's not what the quest is. And Glidden, we believe, uncovered evidence, and we strongly believe we've got photographic evidence of 9-footers. Now, here's the deal. Here's the backstory to all this. A couple of years ago, Jim Watson, who wrote a book called Mysterious Catalina, I was reading it. I was very familiar with the Glidden archaeological digs. I was also familiar with the 9-footers, but I wanted to meet Jim, and we hooked up for lunch, and you know, one thing led to another. And at that point, he said, look, you know, they just discovered, the curator of the Catalina Museum has just discovered a cache of records in the museum, in the attic. And I went, you got to be kidding me. And so one thing led to another, and I contacted John Borgina, the former curator of the Catalina Museum. And it took about 8 months to gain access, get permission, and also a $1,000 contribution, which I was more than happy to give to the new museum. And I finally got access, and I arrived there and spent 5 hours one night, probably about 5 hours the next morning. This was an, everything had been cataloged, Derek. Everything had been picked over, cataloged, sorted. Many of the photographs were in plastic envelopes. I donned my white gloves. There were two tables set up in front of me with white paper on them, and they brought out the museum boxes. We started with the photographs. And it didn't take long. After the first hour, I hit a cache of photographs that were absolute pay dirt. And all of those are in the book. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that we discovered shows Ralph Glidden standing in a recently excavated grave. And in front of him is a very large skeleton in situ. In other words, it's been placed uncovered exactly the same way it was placed. It's not a disarticulated bone pile. It's an articulated skeleton in situ, and there it is. And I knew that this is something anomalous, and I showed that to John Borogina, who had obviously looked at all of this before. But see, the archaeologists that are there, the anthropologists that are there, with all due respect, and John Borogina, with all due respect, have a certain paradigm that they're operating. They're not going in there with the same filter and the same lens that I'm looking at. And I looked at that and I said, you know, I don't know, but that looks like an awfully big guy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gary, I told this to Gary Stearman. He said, you know, LA, there are people that have computer software that can be able to, that will be able to take this picture and based on Ralph Glidden's height, extrapolate the height of the skeleton. So I put an ad on my blog looking for people with computerized programs. Within 24 hours, I had four people. Out of the four, three of them completed the task. So we had a triple blind study going on in regard to the photograph. I did not tell any of the men that were working on the photograph and taking it, digitizing it, putting it in their computer software and analyzing it, that there were three of them working on it. I had a triple blind study, no collusion. All of three of them put the skeleton around 9 feet, slightly under 9 feet. And they all arrived at the same conclusion, or roughly the same conclusion, using different techniques. One of the men, number four, stated in an email, which is in the book, that to the best of his knowledge, there's been no photoshopping. It's an original photograph, no photoshopping to the photograph. I mean, it's with 99.999 certainty. So it's funny, when I came out with this, the instant rebuttal from the naysayers, well, Glidden staged the photograph. He created those skeletons. Excuse me, you know, and you can make up anything. You know, kangaroos can fly too, right? I mean, just because you say he did doesn't mean that that's true. And if he did do it, then why didn't we know about this? He didn't stage these photographs. He didn't have the means to stage the photographs. How would you create something like that? Yeah, you could do it. And yeah, Hollywood's nearby. I get it. But for what purpose?
Yeah.
And he certainly didn't embellish it. There's no other photographic evidence. It's not like he had these things in his museum. He didn't do anything with them. They were packed up, sent to the High Museum, and never seen again. So what's startling about this is that one skeleton, based on Glidden's height of 5'8", is 9 feet. But then we find another skeleton. And again, this one completely missed by everybody except for me. But I'm looking for six fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, there's a skeleton there. And yeah. At the moment I look at it, I went, oh, my gosh, pay dirt. Six fingers, Derek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Six fingers. And one of the researchers, based on the bowl, which is right next to the head, and based on John Borogina's estimation of the bowl at 6 inches, placed a six-fingered skeleton at 9 feet. There was another picture that we found which had a burial. We don't know whether it was – I'm assuming it was a mother and child, but I'm speculating here. But it looked female, the skeleton. But here's the rub. The female had a very large elongated skull. Very, very large. And again, I'm looking for that. That's exactly why I'm there. That's my lens. That's my filter. That's what I'm expecting to see. And below her, at her feet, is probably a 1 or 2 year old, but there's no way to really vet that. And it's got a cone head. It's a very large very large skull, and it's not hydrocephalia. And what's interesting is I A-B'd it from the elongated skull, which is known as Waki, which we're trying to get DNA evidence out of Peru, legally, of course, with archaeologists and the whole deal and the Ministry of Culture and all the permits. But Waki has a very elongated skull, and so did this one. So, I mean, those are three anomalous photographs. And frankly, that's why I'm on the History Channel this Tuesday in search of a lost giants, because that's my intellectual property. I was the one who discovered it. It's published. It's copyrighted. And it's out there. And it's like the naysayers can naysay all they want. You go out to Catalina and do your own research. I'm not making this stuff up. Mm-hmm. The people, the three gentlemen who looked at the photograph and extrapolated the heights, they have no axe to grind. And, you know, if this was, in other words, if it was a stage photograph and all these archaeologists and anthropologists saw this, then why didn't they say so a priori? Why didn't they say it, you know, ahead of time? No one said anything about this. It's only that because I've discovered something which goes up against the so-called Darwinian paradigm, one. Two, it begins to lend credence to the fact that there were nine-footers out on Catalina, that it's not a ruse. It's not a ruse just to sell papers. That Glidden did uncover a few nine-footers, and we found two of them. I believe there's actually more out there, as there are other skeletons, and we've got two or three different sites which we are actively pursuing, even as I speak, to get the proper permits and permission from Native American tribes to go in and exhume a couple of these. And that's what we're trying to do.
The Glidden collection, you mentioned, and you showed some of his notes here, and it's pretty clear that he was not an anthropologist of any sort, because his notes were little more than, I found something here at this location, but he didn't go into any detail as far as the describing how it was found, what was found, the measurements of what was found.
Yeah, it's maddening. It's absolutely maddening. His record keeping is in fact, that's probably too good of a word for him. I mean, there really isn't any record keeping. Mm-hmm. But if he's trying to embellish something, and I raised this point in the book, and I found in his ledger, it just says it's a one-liner. Found a very large skeleton, well over 8 feet. That's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he's trying to do something with this, then that's the place to do it. It's a throwaway line, Derek.
Yeah.
It's a throwaway line. He's also working with a judge who basically says, look, we found a 28-inch femur. Now, again, the naysayers will say, well, the judge doesn't know how to measure, you know, kind of stuff. Yeah. Well, the judge knows how to measure, okay? It's not that long ago. But look, that as it may.
Yeah, they had rulers then. They had tape measures back in the day.
So. Exactly. Yeah, and this is what, I mean, I've had an argument with a tenured archaeologist at a major university. And I said, well, what about the men of letters from the last century who measured these articulated skeletons in situ? And measured them at, you know, 8, 9, 10 feet. Mm-hmm. And you know what? The response was they didn't know how to measure. And I'm not making that up. It's a direct quote.
Yeah.
Men of letters did not know how to measure. Well, I beg to differ.
What happened to the stuff in the Hay Museum? I mean, you've got a picture in there of the collection displayed, as you said, in very grotesque fashion, just bones hanging everywhere to create almost something that looks like from a Hollywood cartoon. I mean, it's Halloween just, cartoon. It's horrible.
It is horrible.
But what happened?
Thank God it's not there.
Yeah. Anymore. But what is there any indication, any clue as to what might have happened to all of that material?
We know that according to the records, Glidden packed up many of the bones and they were setting sail and the ship sunk in the channel. Hmm. How convenient is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I say. So there it is.
People who've listened to this program for a while, familiar with your work, understand the significance of the six fingers and six toes. But for those who might be new to the idea and don't quite get the reference, what's the significance of the extra digit?
Well, this is one of the traits that we read about in the Bible, where it says very specifically that many of the giants had six fingers and six toes. Later on, Native Americans talk about the six fingers. So I actually have another picture, which I just received, which will be in volume three. It's amazing what you find online, Derek. It's amazing what's out there. You just got to do a little digging. People don't know what they've got. But I've got another photograph. So now I've got two of six-fingered skeletons. And look, polydactylism is there. I get all that. You know, that's why the DNA evidence will you know, maybe put a hammer in it or put the final nail in the coffin. The preliminary DNA evidence that we've done in Peru that came from late Lloyd Pye, and he took samples out of Senior Juan's museum and had them tested. I've been in conversation with the geneticist. I've spoken to him at different times. I've actually entered into a contractual agreement with the lab, and we're waiting to get the samples out of Peru legally so we can find out what we're really looking at. But this is, and you've been to my presentation, so you know what basically it came in. This is right from a geneticist. Whatever the sample labeled 3A has come from, it had mitochondrial DNA with mutations unknown in any human primate or animal known so far. The data is very sketchy, though, and a lot of sequencing still needs to be done to recover the complete mitochondrial DNA sequence. But a few fragments I was able to sequence from this sample indicate that if these mutations will hold, we are dealing with a new human-like creature very distant from Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, and Denisovans. I am not sure it will even fit into the known evolutionary tree. The question is this. If they were so different, they could not interbreed with humans breeding within their small population, they may have degenerated due to inbreeding. That would explain buried children. They were either low or not viable. And look, we can argue this point till the cows come home. And it's amazing when Brian Forrester posted this on Facebook, it went viral. And I had it up on my blog. This post went viral. And he got slammed. I had nothing to do with, you know, in fact, Brian didn't either, as far as I know. Lloyd Pye, who's now deceased, got these samples. And he was the one that got them tested. And after he passed away, his geneticist contacted Brian. And talking began. And then, you know, Brian innocently just posted this. You thought we would have robbed the Vatican by the response we got on the internet. And then some of these sites you talk about, you know, the Heriscope sites and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh, the samples were contaminated. How do you know that? I mean, these people have an axe to grind. They're afraid of following the evidence. All we're doing is we're following the evidence. We're going where the evidence points us, and we're publishing it. It's right there. That's why Amitrail 1 and Amitrail 2 is there. You know, you can look at the Raman spectroscopy for yourself, and you can decide whether it was done correctly or not. We can talk about that a little later. I want to clear up something. There's this controversy about one incursion, two incursions, no incursions. It's batty. The bottom line is, in Genesis 3, we hear about the seed war between the Most High God and the fallen one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Most High God says, you know, Yahweh is basically saying to Satan and to Eve, Satan, there'll be enmity between your seed, the fallen one, Satan's seed, and the seed of the woman. Enmity. There's a seed war going on. Then in Genesis 6, and this is why Genesis 6 is so critical, because we actually see the manifestation of the seed war, where everything is happening. The Nephilim are on the earth. The sons of God, which are the B'nai HaElohim, which are the fallen angels, landed on Mount Hermon. Book of Enoch tells us that. Even without the Book of Enoch, we know it's the fallen angelic host, and this is the reason for the flood. Now, people disagree with that. That's fine, you know, but we keep finding evidence. And here's the kicker. This is why I believe in multiple incursions and not the theory that one of Noah's wives' sons somehow were contaminated. There's a vetting process that happens in Genesis. And basically, the Most High God says to Noah, you, your wife, your sons, and your sons' wives. If he's all-knowing, Derek, if he's all-knowing, then I guess he's just a trickster because he doesn't know. He's going to wipe out all the Nephilim but allow one of the wives to come on board that supposedly is contaminated. I don't buy it. I don't buy the theory, with all due respect. Here's why. Moses is writing the Torah. And Moses is writing a Torah and being directly dictated by God on Sinai. And when Moses is writing Genesis, he's writing it 100 years, hundreds of years after the event. Hundreds of years after the event, it's being dictated. God's writing it. Now, if there was one incursion, it should say this. It should say the Nephilim were on the earth, period. That's what it should say.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't say that. It says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of men. And Moses is writing it from his perspective in and around the Promised Land, where he already knows who's there.
Mm-hmm.
He already knows what he's up against, which is the Nephilim. So the bottom line is, we can argue this point. I really don't care about it. People can believe what they want to believe. I'm on the trail. I'm looking at evidence. When we get the DNA evidence, that's going to tell us something. And at that point, then people, you know, have to come to grips with it and somehow tap dance around it. There are multiple incursions. There are incursions happening right now, and it links into the whole alien abduction phenomenon. We talked about this in our Watchers series, but we've got, once again, hardcore scientific proof. We took a red hair, some of the red hair from one of the skulls. This is all in On the Trail Nephilim 2. We show the skull. We took some red hair. Senior Juan allowed us to take it. It had fallen out of the hair, out of the skull, and it was just laying in the display case. We took some of the hair back. We had it analyzed, Raman spectroscopy. There were four hairs that we analyzed. A normal human hair control sample. The second hair was a dyed human hair. The third hair was a red hair from Paracas, from a very elongated skull with only one parietal plate. The fourth hair came from a man who had been abducted and forced to have sex with a female hybrid. And when he awakened that morning, he found a long white hair on his body, which he had the presence of mind to take. So it's the Raman spectroscopy, everything is plotted on a graph. The human hair comes in about three-quarters of the way up on the left-hand side, makes a nice little gentle arc, and then dips off. The dyed human hair comes in underneath where the normal human hair is and just goes straight up at a steady incline and off the charts. Here's where it gets interesting, Derek. And the red hair from Peru is about 2,000 years old. The red hair and the whitish, blondish hair from the so-called female hybrid being.
Mm-hmm.
The slopes, and it's in the book, the slopes of those two track almost identically. And there is a correlation there. And again, it's like everything we present, as we keep piling on the evidence, it seems to show, and I'm saying this from a non-biblical point of view, and this is a scientific viewpoint based on our hypothesis, there seems to be an outside agency which is manipulating the genome. That's what seems to be going on. We see it in antiquity. We see it here again in modernity. And the Raman spectroscopy is a bridge, in my opinion, between the two. Obviously, the DNA evidence, and this is what's so fascinating about this. This is why we're trying to get multiple samples from different places and test them to see if there's a correlation between what we find in North America on some of these burial mounds, which we're trying to get access to, and what we have in Peru.
Hmm.
We're trying to see if there's any type of... So once again, it's like the skeptics can say what they want to say. I really don't care. Right now, the evidence seems to point in the validation of our hypothesis. And that's why we're doing what we're doing. We're not making this stuff up.
Gary Stearman at the Pikes Peak Prophecy Summit made a really interesting statement, and his presentation was very interesting, took an interesting tack, which is that the Bible is essentially documentation of what you described, the war of the seed. It's all about genetics. It's all about human DNA.
Yes. Absolutely.
The reference to Noah in the Bible, Noah was perfect in his generations, which many translations or commentators will take to mean that Noah was extremely, extremely righteous, instead of looking at it through the lens that you're looking through and I concur. The genetics aspect of this. We can understand it in the days before the Messiah, because we saw the enemy of the seed of the woman, the enemy of the coming Messiah, trying to cut off the bloodline before he could be born and serve his and basically fulfill his mission, live a sinless life according to the law, and then die as the perfect sacrifice for the remission of the sins of all who accept him and call him Lord and Savior. What would the purpose in modernity be? What would the purpose be today for this sort of genetic manipulation?
Well, in my opinion, what's going on today is the fallen one is attempting to make man in his own image. As Chuck Missler states, and I've quoted him numerous times on this, and by the way, I got to thank Chuck and Quinn and Ia House, and I was just up there with Bill Salas and Joseph Farah and a whole crew of people, and we spoke up there, and I was presented with the Gold Medallion Award by Chuck, and it was just, for me, it was just an incredible honor to receive something like that. And thank you, Kay House, and just amazing. But Chuck Missler states in one of our Watchers series, I believe it's the very first one, that Satan is outnumbered 2-1. He's creating an army. He just states that matter-of-factly, and I agree. I mean, I completely concur with Chuck's statement. That's exactly what's going on. He's creating an army. There's another reason for it, and I talk about this extensively in the Cosmic Chess Match. And interestingly enough, Doug Hamp came up with the same conclusions, and both of us arrived there independently without any collusion between the two of us, that the fallen one, Satan, was attempting to create man in his own image. Doug's book, title of his book is called Corrupting the Image. Mine is the Cosmic Chess Match. But the bottom line is we believe, and I do believe now, and Watchers 8 gets into this big time with the removal of the so-called implant, alien implant. We believe these implants are DNA upgrades. They're prototypes. And eventually, we think this ties into the mark of the beast. And again, we're in the lab. We extracted one. It's on film. We've got the guy's testimony. We extracted it. It's. I remember when we first started talking about this 6 to 7 years ago, you know, skeptics just laughed at us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how do you beat the film? You know, how do you make up an X-ray and a CAT scan and an ultrasound and a Gauss meter, which is registering 7.5 milligauss? A little piece of metal in this guy's leg is putting off a signal 7.5 milligauss? Are you kidding me? That's astounding.
Mm-hmm.
Double-walled carbon nanotubes in these things, giving off a radio frequency of about 330 gigahertz. Derek, we don't know what it's doing. We don't know how it works. It would be, and this is Stan Friedman's analogy, and it's a good one, it would be like giving Christopher Columbus a nuclear submarine. He'd just sit there with his jaw on the ground. He wouldn't know how any of it worked. He'd look at it and go, what's this?
Mm-hmm.
What's a wire? What's a tube? You know, what's nuclear energy? I mean, that's what we're looking at. This stuff is so far above where we are as human beings. It's just mind-boggling. I don't pretend to understand it all, but you know, I'm looking at stuff and it seems to be pointing. It seems to be giving our hypothesis some veracity,
mm-hmm.
which is good.
Well, and this is why I have no problem being open-minded toward this, because it does seem to have some explanatory value, to borrow a phrase from Mike Heiser, some explanatory value to the apparent genetic component of the UFO phenomenon. Now, some of this may be, I don't want to rabbit trail too far away from your book. So, but anyway, that's, you know, why I've got no problem, you know, welcoming you and others who are speculating about what these things might mean, because it seems to have some support from the stories that we're getting from, you know, people who claim to have been abducted, people who have claimed to have been in contact. I mean, it seems to be consistent with the idea that the fallen ones are trying to either change the human genome for their own purposes, or at least convince humanity, those who are, you know, looking for answers, you know, to the big questions, like why are we here? Where do we go when we die? That there is any answer, some other answer other than, you know, Jesus Christ being the way, you know, the way. So back to your book, On the Trail of the Nephilim, too, because I really want to you got such fascinating things that you've discovered here, and God bless you for putting so many photos in here, because it's hard for people who aren't visual like me. I need to see photographs in order to grasp what you're discussing here. The discussion of the lance that was discovered, that was left at the campsite in Michigan, you know, it's one thing to describe it and say, you know, this is a really huge piece of metal, but it isn't until I see the picture of you and was that Chief Joseph Riverwind with you in the photo?
Yeah, Chief Joseph Riverwind, correct.
And the third fella there holding it between the three of you is like, if this is the tip of a spear, the tip of a lance, you're right, that is a huge piece of metal. Where was it found, and how did the significance of this, or the possible significance of this, come about? Or begin to understand the significance of it. Let me put it that way.
Bob Shelley. Oh, I'm getting a bad echo. Ooh. Bob Shelley had it for a number of years and thought it was a sword at first. And when I first looked at it, I also thought it was a sword. And Chief Joseph corrected us immediately and said, guys, you're looking at it through your cultural lens. It's not a sword. It's a lance. And he proceeded to tell us that Native American lances were about 8 to 10 inches and made of flint, not metal. And this was a whole different deal. When we looked at it, and I picked it up and I attempted to wield it like a sword, there's no way. When you put a handle on this thing, and again, you know, when you think of a lance like this, and go back to the biblical narrative, like his lance was like as big as a weaver's beam. I mean, you get these descriptions. It's like, there's no way a 5'6" guy is going to be wielding this thing. I'm telling you right now, you know, we're going to make a replica of it, take it to someone to make a replica of it and fashion it as a lance just to see what it would be like to try to pick this thing up and run around with it. I mean, it's just a joke. As a sword, it was a complete joke. You put a handle on this thing, it's 10 feet long, and it's like, you know, what am I doing with this thing? You know, it's like, And what cracks me up, it's archaeologists, and this will be in volume 3. It was actually, we saw some of it in volume 1, but you're going to see more in volume 3. When you get a 27-pound axe head, or a very large axe head, there are archaeologists who will insist that this is ceremonial. Well, how do you know if it's ceremonial if the people that left it there are gone and you have no idea what it is? You're just speculating. And that's the problem. There's a lot of speculation. No one really knows. Well, in volume 1, there was a very large Hopewell, which again, Hopewell is the farmer. They don't know who these people were, Derek, and they show up there about 3,000 years ago. It fits the timeline perfectly. But they're there, the Hopewell, and there's a very large spearhead in the museum near Chicago, the Field Museum. And the caption says, you know, ceremonial. And I called the archaeologist up there and spoke to the resident archaeologist and had a conversation. I said, look, where was this found? I mean, you're displaying an item. We don't know where it was found. If it was found next to a 9-footer, it's not ceremonial. It's utilitarian. And that's the problem. There was a private collection I looked at very recently, which will be in volume 3. Axe heads, flints, knives, all this stuff. Guess what? You know, it's a flint knife, Derek, but it's like over a foot long without the handle. Now, you know, a little 5'6" guy? No. That's not going to happen. And this is the deal. These axe heads are huge. And they show wear. It's not ceremonial. There were some big dudes running around. I'll give you one more thing from volume 3. We were up at a place called Flint Ridge. This is where the flint was traded all over the Americas. And this is, there was a trade route going on. People controlled the flint. And in order to break the flint out, they would take a maul, a rock. And, you know, the rock might be, you know, 9, 10 pounds at the most. And you would, you know, raise that rock over your head and throw it down and break the flint. And you take these larger rocks and then, you know, work them from there. Well, where would this guy who has 5 acres on Flint Ridge, and he's a professional. He recreates arrowheads. He makes these incredible points, which are just amazing. Some of them sell for $15,000. That's how amazing his stuff is. And when we asked him, you know, come on the record and let us know and what you discovered. And this is all on film, which will be the stills and stuff will be taken and be used in volume 3. He found a 40-pound maul, Derek, a 40-pound maul. And you can see it. It's got wear. It's the rock is sort of like a pyramidal shape, and the point is all been pitted. And he just looked at me, and I said, "Well," he didn't know what I was writing, but later on, you know, we tipped our hand and stuff. I said, "Well, how big would a guy have to be to wield this?" He sort of chuckled and looked around a little nervously. He said, "Well," and he immediately diverted to this story. He said, "Well, about 20 years ago, they dug up a very large guy up on the hill here. It was over 8 feet, just like that, Derek. Just like that."
Interesting.
Just like
that. Huh. It is curious that we've got mounds all over the United States. And I didn't understand the significance of it at the time, even though I lived in the St. Louis area for, 17 years? St. Louis is the mound city. There were mounds all over St. Louis. In fact, I was at calling on a customer a few months ago, and they had a history of St. Louis, a coffee table book sitting out in the lobby. And I started flipping through it, and I saw guys from the 1880s clearing out space for the Falstaff Brewery to be constructed in the Soulard section of St. Louis now. And they were clearing a mound out of the way. They just leveled them because they were a nuisance when you were trying to expand the city of St. Louis out. And of course, St. Louis is right across the river from Cahokia, where you got the largest mound complex in the United States. In your research, has there been any satisfactory explanation for these giant earthworks?
Well, what's really interesting to me about all this is, and you get this from people, that there was 3,000 braves, Native Americans, that formed a line, and they had birch bark baskets, and dog sleds would haul the baskets, and they would form these like fire bucket brigades with dirt, and they made these mounds. Well, we take issue with that. I've talked to Chief Joseph about it. He comes on the record, and he maintains that Americans did not build these sites. They found them and used them afterwards. Many of these sites show solar alignment, processions of equinoxes and solstices. The Great Circle Mound in Ohio, when you stand there, it is absolutely humongous. It is just huge, over 1,200 feet in diameter. And some of the walls are at least 20 feet high. And there was human sacrifice that was found. This is the work, in my opinion, and this is our hypothesis. We have come to call this, both in North, Central, and South America, Nephilim architecture. And the architects are behind it are the fallen angels, and the ones who do their bidding are the Nephilim. And if there's any human beings around, they view these guys as gods. The fallen angel that shows up is viewed as a god, is worshipped as a god. There are some interesting sites I've been to, which are, again, all in book 3, which I'm doing in-depth study, and I'll be meeting with different architects and also archaeologists to try to correlate seemingly disparate sites separated by thousands of miles and centuries, and yet same architecture, same stuff going on. And Derek, like all this, there's no predecessor to it. There's no culture that precedes the mound builders. There's no culture that we know of that precedes Cahokia. Why suddenly these guys get up on the Monday morning, and I haven't been to Cahokia. That's I'm slated to do that maybe in January, maybe in February. I want to go in the winter when it's cold so the vegetation is down.
Mm-hmm.
I can really see what's going on there. And I'm planning a trip out that way to check out Cahokia at some point, because I need to include that in the book and talk about it. But the mounds are everywhere. And there's a cluster of these, certainly in the central part of the United States, Cahokia seemingly being a center point. But then you've got what's up in Ohio with the Great Circle Mound and the Octagon Mound, and then down to the Serpent Mound. Mm-hmm. And they were connected by a road, which is, again, a misnomer, called the Hopewell Road. It had nothing to do with Hopewell. And Native Americans didn't build stuff like this. But it's all connected. And again, why the serpent? Why the serpent motif? New Ages. Well, the serpent, and I actually write about this in depth in Armored Trail Volume 2. New Ages will insist the serpent, you know, denotes wisdom. Well, yeah, it does. Just like in Genesis, the serpent, you know, you eat the fruit, you'll be wise. You know, you'll be like God. You'll know good and evil. Yeah, you get knowledge, but what kind of price do you pay for it? And so the serpent motif is used by occultists. It's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And it denotes wisdom, but the wisdom is from the second heaven, and it always comes with a price. And I'm working on another book about this. I actually featured a chapter in Armored Trail 2, just this whole deal about the supernatural and shamanism, and why is it that a shaman in South Africa taps into the same stuff as somebody in Australia? How does that work? Separated by 1,000 years and, you know, thousands of miles. How does that work? Because it's the same source. And yeah. The serpent motif, it's the same guy.
Well, I'm glad you led to that, because that was next on my notes. I definitely wanted to cover this. In Chapter 11 of the book, On the Trail 2, you talk about Graham Hancock and his experience with hallucinogens, and your sidebar, which takes up a page and a half, discussing your theory of what these guys are tapping into when they go into these trances, whether they're through spiritual practices or through ingesting substances like ayahuasca. What do you think they're tapping into when they're opening up, and how do you think that process works?
Let's do the latter question. The process works. It's very complex, and it begs the question, who found the information? Where did the information come from? Well, the Book of Enoch, which is not in our canon, but it's quoted 70 times in the Tanakh and referenced in Jude and other places in the New Testament, found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we can at least appreciate it as a historical reference, states that the fallen angels, when they came here, gave us different techniques, showed us the art of weapon making, showed the art of root cutting. Get that root cutting. And here's the deal. Hiawassa is a very complex formula. Where did it come from? You know, why did some guy go, well, if I take this plant here and this plant here and I combine them like this, how did he know that? Where does it come from? In my opinion, Derek, it comes from the fallen ones, just like the Book of Enoch tells us. They come down, they show us stuff. Why do they give it to them? Because it opens up the gateway for communication between a human being and the spirit world. And where they go is the second heaven. And the second heaven is still the residence of the fallen ones. That's where they hang out, in the second heaven. And at some point in time, when we know this is future, Michael will war against Satan and his angels, and Michael will prevail. And this is when the great eviction notice happens. And the fallen one and all the minions are booted out of there. It's an eviction time. And then it says, woe to the inhabitants of earth, because Satan, the fallen one, the dragon, the deceiver of old, is now fallen down to you, and he knows he's really ticked off. He knows his time is short, and he can't get back. The gates are closed. He's stuck here in the space-time continuum. And, of course, that's during the tribulation time. But that's what the second heaven is. That's where the knowledge comes from. It always comes with a price. And we're told specifically in the Torah not to do this, not to engage in pharmakia, not to engage in sorcery or witchcraft or any of this stuff, because that's where it takes you. It takes you to the second heaven, which is the realm of the fallen ones.
Yeah. This is interesting, because I've talked with Dr. Rick Strassman, who wrote a book several years ago about his experimentation with DMT, which he conducted at was it New Mexico State, I believe. That may be the wrong university, but it was in the Southwest, New Mexico or New Mexico State. He's got a new book out, just released this year, about what he calls the spirit of prophecy, and speculating that DMT, as you suggest in the book here, because DMT is one of the major components of ayahuasca, does something. It's a chemical that's produced by the pineal gland, but in small amounts. when you ingest it, or is in the case of his experiments, you inject it into the bodies of the volunteers. They were seeing things that were very real to them. And the thing that struck me about reading the accounts that he cited in the new book, DMT, The Spirit of Prophecy, was the number of accounts where there seemed to be an interest in human reproduction. Some were experimental, and there was one case in one particular volunteer's case where it was a very horrifying dream where he was physically and brutally raped by a couple of beings he described as crocodile-like. So this chapter kind of jumped out at me because having read that book recently, unfortunately, because of his poor health, we weren't able to actually do a follow-up interview. The thing that struck me was that he's in favor of additional experimentation with DMT, even though he believes that DMT might be the process by which Yahweh opened the minds of the Hebrew prophets. And he cites much from the Hebrew prophets, the Old Testament prophets, and compares their experiences with the volunteers in his laboratory to look for correlations. But he ignores the message, the warning that you cited, you know, God warning, don't consult with necromancers, don't consult with mediums, don't.
Exactly.
And he just ignores that part. He believes that we need to try to recreate the experience. The key part of the experience that he's ignoring was that it was initiated by Yahweh in the Old Testament. You didn't decide to become a prophet. You were called. He's the one. God is the one who initiated the whole procedure. Speaking of the Bible, you made mention in the book, citing a passage from Leviticus about skull deformation in the Old Testament, in the Bible.
And, that's Corey Hoffman. Corey Hoffman wrote a paper.
Okay.
Yeah, which I included in the book, and it's just fascinating. And Corey points out, you know, this seems to be talking about head binding. Nothing to do with hair. It seems to be head binding, and that's why it made it into the book. Corey went with us to Peru on the Nephilim Skull Tour, and what we saw there was just incredible. And one more thing, Corey and Aaron, who was also with us, we were at one museum, the Laro Museum in Lima, and they go, oh my gosh, oh, look at this, and I turned, and that picture, of course, is in the book. And we were not allowed to take photographs in this museum. And I said, let me take one of this. And he allowed me to do it. And later on, I showed him the evidence from Catalina. The guy was just blown away. But that tapestry shows all these five-fingered hands, right?
Right.
They're just five-fingered hands. And in the middle, there's one with six fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. I mean, here it is. I'm in Peru, and I'm seeing six fingers. Mm. What can I say? You know, it's just like, come on. It's deliberate.
There was a journal from the 19th century, mid-19th century, written 1842 about a fetus that was discovered back then. And, of course, no photograph, but there are some very detailed drawings of a fetus that was discovered. What was it about this that was unique?
What was unique about it? And let me bop over here to my other computer and boot that up and read it to you. Because what's incredible about this, way back in 1842, there's this controversy going on. Oh, all these skulls are cradle headboarded. And people are going, well, some of them are, but some of them aren't. And so there's this tension between members in academia, researchers, whatever, archaeologists, and back in 1842, there's no photography, so you would take someone who could sketch. You would take an artist with you, or you know, you learned the craft yourself, so you could draw what you were seeing, and that would make it into your presentation. So this is a quote from 1842. The pictures are actually in the book, which is just phenomenal, and the sketches, I should say, of the elongated fetus. Hmm. We ourselves, this is a quote, we ourselves have observed the same fact in many mummies of children of tender age who, although they had cloths about them, were yet without any vestige or appearance of pressure of the cranium. More still, the same formation of the head, elongated skull, presents itself in children yet unborn. And of this truth, we had had convincing proof in the sight of a fetus enclosed in the womb of a mummy of a pregnant woman, which we found in a cave 2 leagues from Tarma, and which is, at this moment, in our collection. Now, once again, 1842, but it's there, Derek, and it's been buried. It's not my find. Brian Forrester linked this to me. It's another person, actually, that's been working on it. I've since, guys from Russia, and I've spoken to him about this, and we've emailed each other a bunch of times. He's also, like I am, you know, we're trying to get to the bottom of this and find out what's going on. But Brian made me aware of this, and of course it made it into the book, and it's profound because immediately, you see, what bothers me is that you get some of these people, and I'm not mentioning names, and all due respect to everybody, but there's a lot of shooting from the hip. Oh, they're all cradle headboard. How do you know that? You can't make a statement like that. You know, I mean, you can't. That's not a fair statement. You know, and that's why in On Betrayal 1, we look at the and say, you know, we got a problem with this. There's only one parietal plate. And yeah, I get the idea that, you know, there's a condition of a skull, and over time that the plates can grow together and the sagittal suture is invisible. But maybe something else is going on. Mm-hmm. And this is like the first time we were down in Peru. Now we get this.
Yeah, you know, and the significance
of 1842.
And the significance being that this was a fetus that was in the womb, so the idea of cradle headboarding is not possible. This
not
was a
possible.
Pregnant woman died, fetus in the womb, showing the elongated head, which the fellows who wrote the piece about, you know, describing the mummy, saying this is the same fact in many mummies of children of tender age, the same formation of the head presents itself in children yet unborn. And then so back to Leviticus 1927, I skipped ahead without making the reference. Once again, assuming people can read my mind, which Sharon keeps reminding me, it doesn't happen. You shall not round off the hair on your temples or mar the edges of your beard, which Corey suggests is indicative of a prohibition on this type of headboarding, which begs the question, which we should have asked, need to ask before we conclude. Why, if they are headboarding, what inspired them to do this anyway? As you say, why would they wake up on Monday morning and decide, hey, I know, let's make the kids into coneheads?
Yeah, it's just absurd when you think about it, and it's global. I think that one of the genetic characteristics of a Nephilim were elongated skulls. I think that Bigfoot or Sasquatch, and we interviewed Ron Moorhead about this, who's been in the field and has and actually interacted with them for about 20 years. He's seen them, okay? Interacted with them, had them come up and shake the tent, the whole nine yards, and they have a sagittal crest. They have an elongated skull. They have a sagittal crest, and they're interdimensional. What I mean by that, I've spoken to people, not second, third hand, first hand witness accounts, where people watch them materialize and then watch them dematerialize. So we're looking at some kind of interdimensional being that has the power to do that, and apparently they have many of them. Have a sagittal crest and an elongated skull. So, look, Derek, this stuff is really weird. Why am I doing this? People go, L.A., you know, why are you wasting the time? And this is the reason. The Darwinian paradigm holds pretty much everyone on the planet in intellectual fascism. If you're an academic, if you're in the scientific community, you don't hold to the Darwinian paradigm, good luck. Ben Stein's classic movie, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, explores this for 90 minutes. If you haven't seen it, go out and get it. Darwinism cuts the knees off of Christianity, or I should say cuts the legs from out from under Christianity, in the sense that with Darwinism, there is no God. There is no God of the Bible. There is no supernatural. Nothing that was written. It's all a bunch of fairy tales. All this just happened over billions of years. That's what they hold. And the Darwinian paradigm is sacrosanct in both academia and the scientific community. And it's a global paradigm, which everyone in those disciplines adhere to. The Nephilim and proof of the Nephilim and genetic proof of the Nephilim will show and hail back to the biblical narrative as being true. And if that's true, Derek, then what else in that book is true? It opens the door to the supernatural. It opens the door to salvation. It opens the door. Once we understand the Nephilim, then, oh my gosh, Joshua and Caleb, all those sites, and then Nephilim architecture, and we're at a seed war, and the words of Yeshua, and this is what salvation's about, and this is why the flood. It's like, it's a pinball going crazy in a pinball machine. It's just going all over from bumper to bumper to bumper. Bam, 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 bam. It opens the door. And that's why we're doing what we're doing. It points back to the biblical narrative. And anyone who gets there, gets to that point, not too far up the road, is the Savior of all mankind, Jesus. And that's why we're doing it, for him, for the kingdom.
Amen, brother. Well, Tuesday night, this coming week. Now, this is going to be posted on the evening of Sunday, December the 14th. Gosh, are we that late into the month already? No, wait, the 7th. I'm sorry. December 7th. I'm looking at the calendar and I can't even read the, yeah, it's analog. That's why. So this will be posted on the 7th. So it's Tuesday the 9th. You're going to be featured on the upcoming episode on the History Channel.
Yes. I have no idea how they're going to spin it, what they're going to do with it. Let's hope they leave it true to form, and we'll just have to pray and see what happens.
All right. And as far as the book On the Trail of the Nephilim 2 and your other work, the Watchers DVD series, Watchers TV, where do people find that work?
LAMarzulli.wordpress.com and LAMarzulli.net. I tell you, we have this incredible offer right now at LAMarzulli.net, LAMarzulli.net, the ultimate L.A. Marzulli collection, the Nephilim trilogy, that's three books, the Cosmic Chess Match, Further Evidence, Amitrail 1, Amitrail 2, and 7, count them, bonus DVDs. Alien Agenda 1, Alien Agenda 2, Signs of the End Times, Field Manual to Spiritual Warfare, UFO Disclosure, The Alien Abduction Phenomena, Prophecies Being Fulfilled in Our Lifetime, 7 bonus DVDs, plus a free calendar, either the Nephilim calendar, On the Trail of the Nephilim, or Watchers calendar. It's, if you added up all those things, this is the $240 package, yours for only $85. It's our best offer ever. So there it is.
Just in time for the holidays. Give it to the skeptic on your list or the person who's curious. I'm really interested. I'm going to take this over to my mother tomorrow. She's 77 and was talking to her about the book tonight. And she said, oh, that sounds really interesting. So we'll see how mom responds to this when she sees On the Trail of the Nephilim 2. But, you know, it's from her that I got my curious mind and my love of reading. So I suspect she may dig into this. I'm curious to get some feedback. But the new book is On the Trail of the Nephilim 2, New Archaeological Research, L.A. Marzulli, always educational. And we look forward to seeing you soon. And let us know when you're coming to Cahokia, because I live just 2 hours away. Sharon and I could be down there and make a day of it. I drive past it.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. We look forward to seeing you and finding out what we can see there.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks for having me on, Derek. Thanks, Sharon. We'll see you soon.
And if you don't already know where to go to find L.A. Marzulli's work, you'll find links in the show notes at vftb.net. That's vftb.net. A couple of stories in the news to relate here as I record this on the evening of December 7th, 2014. By the way, a tip of the headphones to those who served in the military had the opportunity today, as I sang with the group that I've been a part of for these last, well, almost 4 years now, 3.5 years, the Coles County Barbershop Chorus in East Central Illinois. We perform an annual Christmas benefit concert. This was the 40th annual this year, and free will offering is taken and money donated to local homeless and food bank charities. But one of the members in the group was an up-and-coming left-handed pitcher, needless to say, his nickname is Lefty, who had his career interrupted by World War II and was actually based at Pearl Harbor after the attacks on December 7th of 1941. So, again, tip of the headphones and I don't mean that flippantly, to those who have served in years past. We know, as we've talked about in this program and on a PID radio many times, that our military is not always used in ways that would befit the Christian ideal, but be that as it may, those who have served, whether voluntarily or through the draft, still we salute you and we appreciate your service. So, again, quite an honor to get to know this gentleman and be a part of a group that to which he belongs. So, the Ebola outbreak that is continuing in Africa, as the news reporting has quieted down here in the United States, and to date we've only had 4 confirmed cases here in the United States, some other suspected cases, but still, thankfully, we've not seen it break out on these shores, and nor do we want it to. Sharon has said, despite the fact that she's written a book about Ebola and its relationship to prophecy, she would be happy to see it sitting on a shelf collecting dust because the disease has burned itself out. That has not yet happened in Africa, sadly. And there are vaccine trials now beginning in Knoxville, Tennessee. There was a small-scale trial that took place recently at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. The New Orleans Center for Clinical Research, which is now based in Knoxville, Tennessee, and they moved it after Hurricane Katrina, is beginning trials with a watered-down version of the vaccine that was developed, the experimental vaccine developed at Walter Reed. They say that there is no risk to the public from this vaccine. It does not contain attenuated Ebola virus, which would be very dangerous to try to create a vaccine from. It does have a protein from the Ebola virus, and that's what you want the body to respond to. You want the body to respond to the protein coat, develop antibodies for it so that it can shut down the Ebola virus should it be introduced into the body. So anyway, those trials should begin in Knoxville, Tennessee fairly soon. We know some folks, listeners, who are in the Knoxville area, and Sharon has kind of counseled them on the side. Don't volunteer. A furry convention was disrupted in Chicago as several thousand people dressed, some dressed anyway, as animal characters were evacuated from a Hyatt Hotel in suburban Rosemont. This took place early Sunday morning, December the 7th. A furry convention is where people who are interested in anthropomorphic animals and art, literature, and performance based on anthropomorphic animals get together. Thousands of people attend these conferences around the nation every year. We've been told by someone about a conference in Pittsburgh every year, which, based on the news description of the event in Chicago, it was fairly harmless. People who just enjoy dressing up like animals and engaging in various events related to anthropomorphic animals. Conference in Pittsburgh, and I'll need to do a little more research on it. Sounds like it goes a little bit further, but this is something we kind of keep an eye on as we delve deeper into the transhumanist movement. Anyway, this particular conference disrupted early this morning by an intentional release of chlorine gas. Apparently, pelletized chlorine was released in a stairwell, and then the fumes emitted by the solid chlorine spread through the hotel. Some people taken to the hospital for nausea, dizziness, and so forth, but no one seriously hurt. On a similar, well, not exactly a similar note, but because there were animals involved, I thought, well, let's put these two stories together, make for a better segue. Wesley J. Smith, whose work we have referenced many times on this program and whose work you should be following, he blogs at nationalreview.com. His blog is called Human Exceptionalism, and he is one of the best voices on the side of human exceptionalism. The fact that, I mean, we approach it from more of a theological perspective, the idea that God created humanity as his imagers on earth. Not that God is, you know, a biped standing between 5 and 6 feet tall, roughly, you know, 10 fingers, 10 toes, that sort of thing. But we're created by God to serve a unique role on planet Earth. And the word imager is derived from the work of Dr. Michael Heiser, who said, essentially, and I'm oversimplifying it, but we serve in roughly the same capacity over planet Earth that God serves over the cosmos, over all of creation. That is what it means to be created in his image. Well, there are those out there who deny the idea, reject the idea of human exceptionalism, and there was, in fact, a lawsuit filed recently on behalf of a chimpanzee in New York City. And the court in New York, to their credit, according to the New York Times, ruled unanimously on Thursday that the chimpanzee could not be considered a legal person and thus sue for his freedom. This story sounds like a case of the world gone mad, and it's easy to laugh about it and point at how silly this crusade is, but it is ongoing. There will be other cases like this. We're glad that the judges in New York rejected this case, voted unanimously against it, came up with a pretty sound legal justification. But there will be other trial cases until they find a judge who's willing, and this is what Wesley points out, willing to make history and grants personhood, grants civil rights to a non-human. The other reason this story is significant, again, not because of the silliness of the cause. There's actually a dark side to this that we need to be paying attention to as Christians. The drive to eliminate human exceptionalism will ultimately result not only in the creation of a category of non-human persons, chimpanzees, gorillas, perhaps dolphins, based on some criterion, perhaps a minimum level of cognition under which these non-humans are considered persons. On the flip side of that coin, though, are people who are, whether through genetics or through some tragic or severe injury, no longer meet the cognitive requirement to be considered a person in the eyes of these people who hold to personhood theory. So then you would not only have non-human persons, but then you would have non-person humans. Humans no longer entitled to the rights and protections guaranteed in the United States by the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. A step toward denying the unique status of humanity. Wesley J. Smith approaches it from more of a secular perspective, which we appreciate because there are those who would dismiss arguments simply because they're being made by a Christian or someone who is overtly Christian. So he tailors his argument to, brings his argument from a secular, logical, ethical perspective without bringing the Bible into it very often. And we appreciate his work on that regard. Worth following for that, reason. But also when cases like this pop up, again, it's easy to laugh at them, but there is a dark side to it. And that dark side is the category that they wish to create of non-person humans. Think Terry Schindler Schiavo, if you remember that case. The woman who is ruled to be in a vegetative state and her husband was allowed by the court to starve and dehydrate her to death. That is what's coming as we slide further into a post-Christian world and into a culture of death. We'll leave it at that. There are a few other things in the news, but we'll pass on those as we've gone well beyond an hour on this program. Sharon's book on Ebola, again, I'll just point that out simply because I am her number one fan. And remind you that it is available at all the usual locations, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and SurvivorMall.com. Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse, a good explanation of what Ebola is, why it is a threat, without being alarmist and without being really depressing. She actually manages to work quite a bit of hope, the hope promised by God through his word into this particular book, and also some very reasonable and common sense steps for preparing, whether it's for an Ebola outbreak or some other type of pestilence that might require us to depend on our own selves for some period of time. Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse. Coming up on Wednesday night, we'll talk about kingdom government and sheep nations. Daniel Duvall, a young man that we met for the first time at the Chicago Prophecy Summit a couple of years ago, struck us as a very intelligent young man, was gracious enough to have Sharon and I on his podcast here not long ago, earlier this year. He's released a book here just within the last month about the concept of kingdom government and sheep nations. This relates to the judgment of Jesus described in Matthew 25, where he judges among all the nations, those who fed him, clothed him, helped him, or, you know, help the least of these, my brothers, according to Jesus, essentially did the same for him. And they are counted as sheep and put on his right hand those who refuse to help those in need. He counts as goats and put them on the left hand. So what does it mean to be in a sheep nation? How do you achieve that status? How do you achieve kingdom government? To be honest with you, when I heard the title of the book, I thought Daniel was drifting down the path of the dominion theologists, but that apparently is not the case. Heard his recent interview on Canary Cry Radio, and once again, Basil and Gons did a magnificent job. Fascinating conversation. I recommend that you find that at canarycryradio.com, and then listen in on Wednesday night, December the 10th, as I upload that interview with Daniel Duvall here on A View from the Bunker. Beyond that, working on an interview with Catherine Albrecht, co-author of the book Spy Chips some years ago. She's also written a book of prophecy, or written a book about prophecy for children. That's kind of an interesting approach, called I Won't Take the Mark, and we just need to confirm a time on that, so don't know exactly when that'll be uploaded, but that is something that'll be coming up here in the next few weeks. And I have also agreed to take a look at whether Christians should celebrate Christmas, and have that program coming up within the next week or two as well. That may be just me rambling on for an hour rather than bringing a guest in and asking a guest to put themselves in the middle of what is proving to be a sadly contentious debate. But I'll take a look at that, and we'll do a program on that here within the next couple of weeks. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme, musically, by Kevin MacLeod, www.compitech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.